You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 19th of February 2019 on Monocle 24. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up...
The twilight hour of socialism has arrived in our hemisphere, and frankly, in many, many places around the world.
Or has it? Senator Bernie Sanders thinks not and has announced that he will join the Democratic field bidding for the chance to topple Trump next year. Also ahead, we hear from CNN's Will Ripley about what 19 visits to North Korea have taught him about the hermit state. Plus,
I think about what I want to do. Well, I think I found a good solution. I don't discuss it with marketing people. I do it.
We reflect on the passing of fashion totem Karl Lagerfeld, who has died at the age of 85. And we'll hear from Peter Tatchell on the day that the great British director Derek Jarman joins the coterie of Londoners to have had a former residence decorated with one of English Heritage's blue plaques. That's all coming up on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who was one of a dwindling coterie of Americans not seeking the Democratic nomination for president, has announced that he too will, after all, run in 2020. Sanders, who sits in the Senate as an independent, has experience, of course. His insurgent tilt at Hillary Clinton in 2016 fell short, but introduced into American mainstream political discourse a variety of positions widely regarded in America as deeply suspicious socialist subversions, state health care, livable minimum wage, free tertiary education, but generally thought of elsewhere as unremarkable centre-right common sense. This time, however, Senator Sanders will not be the plucky underdog, but will be starting among the favourites. I'm joined with more on this by Dr. Jeannie Zeno, Professor of Political Science at Iona College in New York. Jeannie, first of all, I think we do have to grapple with the obvious question where Senator Sanders is concerned. Is 77 too old to be running for president?
It's a good question. When he ran in 2016, it was an issue that was raised, as it was in the case of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, as well as a pending race potentially by Joe Biden. So age is a real issue and a real concern. And I happen to think it would be. I'm one of those people who thinks just like presidential candidates should release their tax information, which our president does not agree with. I also think we have a right to see about their health and to make sure they're in good health. And this was an issue that came up again with Hillary Clinton last time. And I do think it's a fair question for Bernie Sanders. You know, you elect somebody for 4 years. You do have a right as a voter, I think, to know that at 77, they're in pretty good health and can serve the entire, you know, the entire time. And let's not forget, this, you know, starts in 2020 and ends in 2024, 2021 to 2025, actually. So, you know, he will be even older by the time he entered the White House, if he did.
Assuming Senator Sanders can find an answer to that question that satisfies a plurality of Democratic primary voters anyway, is he a serious chance? Is it imaginable that Bernie Sanders could be elected president late next year?
He has a serious chance of getting the nomination. I think it's going to be more of an uphill battle even than he faced last time around. But we cannot forget that in a really, really difficult 2016 primary race against a candidate funded with over $1 billion in Hillary Clinton, he came in a very close second. So I think it would be foolish to count him out. That said, there's a lot more competition this time around. And the things that made Bernie Sanders so attractive in 2016 to young people, to people on the left, well, they have other choices now. They have choices of people like Elizabeth Warren. They have choices of people like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker. There are other progressives in the race now. So Bernie Sanders is not, you know, the only option out there as he was for people on the progressive left in 2016.
Sanders has been revving people up, well, as of today in the announcement of his run, by talking about finishing the revolution they began. Can he at least claim to have changed the discourse in American politics, especially within the Democratic Party? Has he been responsible, leaving aside whether or not that was a good idea or not, for dragging the party leftwards?
He absolutely can. And I think this is one of the cases where one individual had such an amazing impact on a nation and a political party and never even won the nomination. But Bernie Sanders almost single-handedly, not quite, but almost single-handedly changed the trajectory of the Democratic Party, or at least he was at the forefront of the movement to the left. You know, I live in New York, and this is a very, very progressive state, as is California. You're hard-pressed to find a Republican in these states. You know, a lot of that is owed to Bernie Sanders. And, you know, ideas that he talked about in 2016 that people were sort of shocked by here, you know, Medicare for all, you know, a free college education, some things you take for granted over there that, you know, were anathema over here, are really, you know, now sort of a run of the mill. People on the Democratic left have accepted these as, we can do this and we accept this. So Bernie Sanders has had an enormous impact. He can claim credit for all of that. And he has pushed the party to the left. We see that with the very young, energetic, progressive Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who had such an impact on the Democratic Party in the House already.
So all that being the case, can Bernie Sanders rerun his 2016 campaign, or does he need to come up with new ideas?
I think he can still run on some of the ideas he had, and as he's talking about, sort of finish what he started. But again, I think the challenge, there's many challenges. A number of individuals in the race who weren't there last time around, which means the pool of money that's available. He was able to raise so much money last time around. That is going to be harder to get. It's going to be harder to get the big crowds he did last time around, because remember, at that time, there was really one, maybe only two other options in the Democratic primary. So I think it's going to be hard for him in a race that looks like we could have, you know, somewhere around 15, 20 viable candidates. And as you look at the latest head-to-heads, he's still only within a margin of error of beating Donald Trump, as are all the rest of the candidates, except for potentially Joe Biden if he chooses to run. And that's what I think Democrats are really looking for. On top of everything else, they want to make sure they get a candidate that can beat President Trump. So Bernie Sanders is going to have to show he has what it takes to take on a really tough adversary in Donald Trump, who's already, as you know, been on the campaign trail already last weekend, for instance. So his 2020 campaign has been up and running since he got to the White House. He's going to be a formidable challenge for Bernie Sanders and all of these Democratic contenders.
And you're quite right in pointing out that it's a very different Democratic field than it was in 2016. And obviously, Senator Sanders' big shtick in 2016 was that he could portray himself as the insurgent running against the establishment, as personified by Hillary Clinton. But this time, he's not the plucky, unknown ragamuffin outsider, and there isn't really a Democratic establishment. How does he adjust for that?
Absolutely. Everybody now is trying to claim the outsider status, even though many of them, like Bernie Sanders, are from the Senate. Cory Booker, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, Kristen Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, you could just, the list goes on and on. So he's going to have to claim, I think, not necessarily the outsider status this time as much as the leader of the progressive wing of the party. And again, in that position, he's got a contender in somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who really does, have the ability to claim that mantle. She was a potential challenger last time around, chose not to run in deference to Hillary Clinton. But she does have that. I think another thing not to forget about Bernie Sanders, which is important in the Democratic Party today, is he is a white male. And you see a Democratic Party that is looking for diversity. And I think Bernie Sanders, just like some of the other challengers out there, are going to have to answer the question, do we need another white male in this race? And we've seen some of the, you know, potential contenders already answering that question, including Michael Bloomberg, including, you know, people like Joe Biden and others who are having to answer this question, because diversity is important to the Democratic Party, as is your progressive leanings. And he has one, but not the other.
Well, on the subject of the demographic realities, then, is there, as far as it's possible to tell, a particular cohort that Sanders plays well with? Who are his natural constituents?
I think his natural constituents are the people on the very left of the Democratic Party, but it is not necessarily the women, and it's not necessarily this minority base of African-American women that are so explosively energetic in the party. So he does sort of appeal, I would say, a little bit more to the progressive left that are more suburban and more white and more male. And he's going to have to break out of it. I mean, Bernie Sanders is an independent from Vermont, a state which is a demographic about 90-95% white. And that's not to say that his policies by any means, you know, portend any kind of discriminatory leanings. It's just to say that that's the demographic he's represented and that's who he is. And, you know, I think one of the things he'll be asked repeatedly, would you choose a woman or an African-American or a Latino as a running mate? How do you address this issue that so much of the energy in the party is coming from African-American women? I mean, that's why the Democratic Party had Stacey Abrams give the response to Donald Trump's State of the Union not long ago, because the party recognizes this is where much of their base and much of their vote comes from. And so he's going to have to show that he can garner that kind of support in the same way Barack Obama did if he's going to win in a general election against somebody like Donald Trump.
Jeannie Zeno at Iona College in New York, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. This is the Monocle Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House in London. Will Ripley is one of very few people walking the planet who can claim not only to have visited North Korea, but to have done so 19 times. He's not merely an adventurous holidaymaker, rather, however. As a foreign correspondent for CNN International, he has made it his business to document the inner workings of one of the world's most secretive states. Monocle's James Chambers recently caught up with Will Ripley. James began by asking what he thinks this year's summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump will be like after the peculiar theatrics of the first.
Well, let's hope the sequel is better than the original, at least in terms of substance, because I think Singapore was very heavy on symbolism and photo ops and light on substance. And if this summit in Hanoi is going to be considered a success, obviously they need to come away with a plan, which means details, specific steps to build trust and to work toward the ultimate goal, which is North Korea denuclearizing.
You were in Singapore for last year's summit. What was it like covering the event as a journalist?
It was surreal to think of where we were for 2017 when I was in Pyongyang and President Trump would tweet something insulting and terrifying, and then to see the North Korean officials react. You didn't see any way out of that other than some sort of confrontation, whether it be military or otherwise. It had me and a lot of people in the region very nervous. And to see how the situation transitioned from that, from fire and fury, to Trump and Kim exchanging these letters and the gushing language that Trump uses, I'm really in awe of how North and South Korea work together in the final hour, I feel, to orchestrate a dramatic U-turn. Because the diplomacy, despite, you know, Shinzo Abe possibly nominating Donald Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize, the diplomacy began with President Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un communicating through back channels and deciding to come up with a plan to use the Olympics to springboard into diplomacy. And then they brought President Trump into the process, gave him a lot of credit publicly, but essentially almost gave the U.S. no choice but to go down this diplomatic road when there had been a lot of reporting indicating that they had already decided they were going to go down a different path. Now President Trump is unsurprisingly taking credit for the whole process. But look, as long as he's engaged and as long as he goes into Singapore with realistic expectations and a desire to make a substantive deal, then he could be the U.S. president who did what all the others could not, which is to change fundamentally the dynamic and the situation on the Korean Peninsula. And already tensions have been dramatically reduced, and all of the stakeholders in the process do deserve some credit for that, including President Trump.
North Korean relations with the outside world seem to go in these in cycles. They open up, they want to get some concessions, and then they slam the door shut. You get a lot of kind of old Korea hands who are very cynical about this latest opening up. You know, do you think that this time is any different to times in the past?
You do have in Kim Jong-un a North Korean leader who is more worldly, more at least in tune with the outside world than his predecessors. You also have an unconventional U.S. president who was willing to take a dramatic step that any other president would have scoffed at, which is to agree to a meeting up front. A lot of people criticized the Singapore summit, and rightfully so, because in the end, there wasn't much in terms of tangible results other than shifting the momentum, reducing the tensions. History does repeat itself. And even back in 1994, you know, President Clinton came very close to opening liaison offices in Pyongyang. And then the new administration came in and everything fell apart. Madeleine Albright visited Pyongyang. Now, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has visited four times. So things could go down the same road as they have in the past, or this could be different. And a lot of it does rest on what happens in Hanoi.
You mentioned that Kim Jong-un understands the West or has more exposure to the West than his father or his grandfather. Looking at it the opposite way, do you think the West understands Kim Jong-un?
That's been a big concern of mine for a number of years, because as I started going into North Korea and covering that story regularly, and it became essentially my sole focus at CNN for a couple of years at when tensions were at their highest, you would hear U.S. politicians, including President Trump, say things about North Korea that were in many ways cliche, kind of outdated views, an old script, which is actually the words of the North Koreans that they used to describe their negotiations that fell apart with Mike Pompeo in July when he left the country and they accused him of making gangster-like demands. I have seen an evolution, certainly in the public statements, and I'm really encouraged, particularly by Stephen Biegun, the new U.S. envoy for North Korea. He gave a speech at Stanford earlier this year, and it was a realistic, sober assessment of where things stand and where things have the potential to go. And so I think that the administration and its officials have learned as they go, just like I did. It's not a black and white issue. It's a complex, layered issue with so much historical background, so much pent-up mistrust. And yet I have always gotten the sense that the North Koreans are keen to engage with the outside world, to be a part of the international community. But they are going to do it in their own way, and they insist that they be given the, I should say their leadership insists that they be given the right to exist with their current system in place. One thing that you don't hear the U.S. and North Korea talking about a lot right now is the issue of human rights. And that is because it remains extraordinarily sensitive for the North Koreans. But I've talked to a lot of experts who think the human rights situation in North Korea could evolve organically over time if the country is brought into the fold, if they get a seat at the table, and if they become more economically prosperous due to the opening up of trade and the normalization of relations. Over time, the society itself evolves, and perhaps that could also mean better living conditions for people who live there, and who knows what other changes could happen as a result.
We in the West, whether it's the media or Hollywood, have created this caricature of Kim Jong-un as this kind of funny and fat dictator, a bit like we did with his father. Do you think that kind of caricature helps or hinders our relations with North Korea?
It absolutely hinders relations with North Korea. I was on a reporting trip when a reporter from another network relied on physical descriptions about Kim's weight and appearance and, you know, qualifications or lack thereof. He was reprimanded and kicked out of the country while we were there. Would news organizations report in the same way about other world leaders? Obviously, President Trump is a caricature as well. You know, sometimes these unconventional leaders, we make fun of them, but is that really productive? I think the key is you try to understand where this leader comes from. And I always have just tried to cover North Korea with respect, following their laws like any other government, which means being very skeptical of the claims they make. We went to their nuclear test site in May and watched them blow up the buildings and the tunnel entrances. And we were in the country at the nuclear test site saying, there are no experts here to verify what we're seeing. This looks very dramatic, great pictures for television, but who knows, is this really an irreversible step? We have no qualification to assess that. And of course, later experts said that, frankly, it wasn't. So there's a lot to cover with North Korea without focusing on the low-hanging fruit of making fun of how Kim Jong-un looks. And within his country, partially due to propaganda, partially due to just the system and people growing up with these portraits of the leaders in their homes and their offices, there is, in my view, genuine admiration, fear, respect for him. You know, people, when they encounter him, I don't necessarily think that those reactions are fake. You know, he means something to the North Korean people, and particularly has proven himself because they've seen how he has held himself on a world stage and the kind of reaction that he's received. And I think there's a genuine sentiment inside the country that people are proud of what he's done and believe that he might have the key to, you know, giving them what he's promised them, which is a better life. That said, anybody who has a dissenting view is punished or worse. And you don't have any freedom of speech in North Korea. You don't have any freedom ideologically to believe anything other than what the government tells you. And so I say that there are some people who feel that way about him. If there were people who felt differently, they would certainly never talk to me about it.
CNN's Will Ripley there speaking to Monocle's James Chambers. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Up next, the death of a fashion legend.
The pendulum is a swinging, and these days it's the city of Paris that's turning heads with retail innovation. Monocle Films traveled to the 16th arrondissement to sample Le Bon Marché's new addition to La Grande Épicerie family.
Food is a lot of memory. It's memory with your mother, with your grandmother. Food, it's a pleasure. You have to find this game with a product. I try in the architecture to have this sensibility.
For a filmic tour of La Grande Épicerie, Rive Droite, head to monocle.com.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. The fashion powerhouse Karl Lagerfeld has died at the age of 85. In a moment, we'll hear from Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. But first, here is a clip from an interview Tyler did with Karl Lagerfeld in Paris in 2014.
Information became so easy that we are over-informed by things we are not supposed to know, who are not that great to know. But that is something what never existed before. So it is too dangerous to say, no, it was better before. It wasn't better. It was just different. It's up to us to adjust to our times. The times are not supposed to adjust to our perhaps passéist taste. So you have to be careful. You like it or you don't like it. The question is, that's the way it is. You can do nothing against it. That's an evolution, and that evolution cannot be stopped and will not be stopped tomorrow morning.
Tyler, it feels only a matter of weeks since you came back into the office. You just met Karl Lagerfeld in New York. Tell us about that meeting and about the man that you met then.
Well, indeed, it was just a few weeks ago, Andrew. It was just in the run-up to Christmas. Karl, with, of course, Chanel, was doing a big show at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, very much focused on the whole world of Egyptology. And I was there for an interview, part of a collaboration that we are doing with Chanel. And it was one of those classic moments, because probably the first time I interviewed him was about, goodness, 25 years ago, when we were both cub reporters, meaning you and me, Andrew. And you know, every time, you know, Karl would be sort of surrounded by different minders, different PRs, et cetera, and everyone would always say, oh, you know, you only have, you know, 10 minutes or 15 or 20 minutes with Mr. Lagerfeld. And I guess over time, you've sort of realized that if the questions were right and the setting was perhaps also fitting, you could spend a long time with this gentleman and talking about absolutely everything. And that's exactly what happened in New York. We were told that we maybe only have 25, 30 minutes with him. And then, you know, well over an hour had passed and we were talking about everything from Tante Angela Merkel to the state of France today, manufacturing his views about Twitter and mystery and all kinds of things in a classic sort of Karl manner.
And just tell me, in a time when luxury brands seem to announce new heads of their various labels every couple of years, how come he managed to survive for so long at the top of his game at Chanel, at Fendi? He's been at Chanel since 1983. What gave him that longevity?
We have to remember that even, you know, pre-83, here was a man who already had an extensive career in fashion, already working for a number of houses, was very much a fixture of Paris, you know, design life. But of course, remembering that he arrived from Hamburg many years before that. And you know, the son of course, from a merchant family, you could say, arrived in Paris in sort of grand style. And as I said, was an individual that, you know, managed to not just gain experience in various ateliers, but I think was also just exposed to so many different levels of culture. And I think that's partly why the man has had such staying power, because there's just this depth of knowledge. And I can remember saying to a friend who was working at Fendi once upon a time, the man is like a walking museum, because, you know, at one turn he could talk about Spanish painters of a certain period. He could then go and talk about what he might have seen at the Salone in Milan recently and what he liked in contemporary furniture, and then could go and talk about 1930s architecture in Biarritz as well. And I think that was, again, something which is very important when you look at his career at Chanel, because this is not an individual we're talking about who would say, oh, I'm feeling for palazzo pants this season, or I think that we should be doing more zips. Mr. Lagerfeld always started with a story. So, you know, even if you look at the last couture show they did, this was very much a vision of Coco Chanel's house. And someone said, you know, he would start with cypress trees, and it was always based on a setting. It always had to be this geographical snapshot, and then he would go with his team and build a collection around that. And I think it's a very unique way of working. I almost sort of feel that probably a lot of designers post-rationalize that when they have to write a press release, but this was his starting point.
And at a time when, you know, luxury for many brands, they're trying to make it open access for all, they're trying to feel a little bit more democratic about what they do, he still believed in luxury in many ways, didn't he? What do you think that the Lagerfeld version of luxury looked and felt like?
Well, I asked him a question along those lines, saying, you know, Carl, we're sitting in a time where there's been such acceleration, everything moves incredibly fast, and certainly retail, that, you know, fast fashion, of course, has affected so many things. And of course, Chanel is in a position where they're doing upwards of 10 shows a year now, you know, not just the main season, but specials that they do around the world. And often he was in attendance at all of those things. And I said, you know, is it you know, a desire or a relationship to be closer to what's happening on the street? And he said, excuse me, because I have to stop you, darling. He said, I don't know what the street is. He said, I live in a bubble, and a very nice bubble. Now, if you take that in any context today, people would be outraged. PRs would be shutting you down. You can't say something like that. That was classic Carl. I think, you know, right up until the very end, and you know, probably we have one of the last interviews with him. And, you know, he didn't care. And there was a sense of, it's all right to be outspoken. And you know what? And he did live in a bubble. I think one of the remarkable things about him was that, you know, there were very few people who could get close to him. And certainly from, you know, the people, of course, in his own team, and then the people working for Chanel, etc., he resided in a very special place.
And what do you make of his trademark look that he kept for many, many years, these high collars, the hair tied back, the dark glasses? You know, he's obviously a man who understood brand. Do you think it was all really about brand?
In many ways, I think he would shudder at that, because I remember him also saying, you know, one thing I don't believe in is, he goes, I cannot hear about the M word. And to him, the M word was marketing. And probably, I think we think about brand, he probably didn't speak in terms of brand. But my goodness, here was someone who really cultivated a style, stuck with it. We have to remember he sort of transformed himself as well. He talked about his inspiration, or being inspired by Hedi Slimane, you know, whether we're talking sort of 15, 20 years ago. And remember, he went through that real sort of transformation. He became incredibly slim. He wanted to always be seen in skinny denim. And as you said, the white shirts, the high collared and white jacket that was sort of a take on smoking. And that became his, you know, his signature style. You know, maybe if we rewind 25 years ago, he was more known for his fans and maybe a slightly sort of more foppish style. But, you know, that was trademark him. And I think that, you know, more than anything else, this is something he mastered. And I think one of the things that was really outstanding when I think back to the times that I spent talking to him was he talked about codes, and you couldn't speak in terms of, you know, what was the essence of a brand like Chanel, but there were a series of codes that just had to make it part of that collection. And when you understand codes, then I think you really are understanding brand. And I think, you know, probably on a final point, this is one of the amazing things, and it's a topic, you know, that we spend some time on, Andrew, sort of now and again. You know, you asked the question about so many houses right now, you know, someone suddenly sort of bolts for the door, and then there's always a big announcement about who's going to replace them. And there's so much turnover. at other houses, you know, be they in Milan or Paris. One of the interesting things about Chanel is it's a long-standing team at the top, you know, people who've worked together for decades and decades. And I think that's also part and parcel of what's made it an incredibly tight brand, that you have people who really understand those codes. And I think that's why he has someone like Virginie under him. There's been a lot of talk about successorship. We'll see if they go for a big name or if they stick to doing what they do, because it's been such a tight-knit family.
So finally, just in a few words, Tyler, what do you think we have lost today from the world of fashion?
I think we've lost an outspoken voice, a keen observer. This is a gentleman who is very much part of an era, I think truly international. I mean, having to think about someone who, you know, came from Germany, became a fixture in France, an icon in France, and certainly an icon of the fashion and luxury industry. And I know we often sort of talk in terms of, you know, of things being an end of an era, but I just think his take on the world, his tone, his keen eye, I think all of those things, they're kind of gone, because in a way you couldn't control Karl. I think you have a lot of people who maybe are employees of brands, and he felt firmly part of Chanel.
Monocle's Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck remembering the late Karl Lagerfeld. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. Here are some of the other stories we're following today. UK Home Secretary Sajid Javid has revoked the British citizenship of Shamima Begum, who left London as a 15-year-old 4 years ago to join Islamic State and now wishes to come home with her newborn baby. The legal grounds for such a decision are unclear. Though it is illegal to render someone stateless, Ms. Begum is also believed to hold Bangladeshi citizenship, though she has claimed not to possess a Bangladeshi passport, and at any rate this does not consider the citizenship status of her child. The possibility that Mr. Javid has calculated that this fairly transparent grandstanding will endear him to voters, whether or not it stands up in court, cannot be ruled out. New York City has taken steps to ban what is known as hair racism, that is, corporate strictures forbidding hairstyles such as afros and cornrows disproportionately worn by black people. New York's Human Rights Commissioner Chair Carmelin Mallalas disputed the common excuse that such rules were about the maintenance of professional standards and that instead they were a way of, quote, limiting the way black people move through workplaces, public spaces, and other settings. Businesses who fail to observe the new guidelines will face fines of up to $250,000. And the top prize at the inaugural World Restaurant Awards has been won by a tiny beachside place in South Africa whose 6 staff have no formal culinary training and whose head chef sources many ingredients directly from the local seashore. Declared Restaurant of the Year was Wolfgat, which opened in 2016 near the small fishing village of Paternoster. It serves a 7-course tasting menu costing only 850 rand or about $60 and seats just 20 diners. Congratulations to Wolfgat, and for everyone else, good luck getting a table now. This is the Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. This week's edition of our business show, The Entrepreneurs, sees Daniel Bache looking at 4 startups making a big impact in healthcare in the public and private sectors. One of those companies is Patientory, an Atlanta-based company founded by a career medical researcher turned entrepreneur, Chrissa McFarlane. The platform logs and securely stores patients' individual treatments and health information, data which they can access at any time, and facilitates communication between consumer and their healthcare providers. Daniel began by asking how putting data in the hands of patients can help them.
Just based on my experiences, really seeing the need, especially among chronically ill patients who might have, you know, multiple specialists look after them, to really have an organized and centralized place to store their health data, especially with, you know, the aging population and baby boomers, we see a lot of this healthcare is now going to go towards their kids. So it's really easy and efficient to have a central place to carry that information on a mobile phone, you know, especially for travel purposes, wherever you go, you know, there's access to that data.
I'm curious where this sort of fits, because part of what you do is rooted in the not-for-profit sector. So that's perhaps a little bit different than just launching a platform that is for profit. You're trying to get investors and backers, mm-hmm. and you're growing that way with a scale or a set plan. But how is that different when it's rooted in the medical world and partly in the not-for-profit?
Profit world.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think especially with blockchain, this open source technology definitely breeds like two sides of the business. It's definitely a business for social impact. At the same time, we're able to sell software, you know, on a for-profit purpose. But I think this is the trajectory and just the way the world in the future is going to have sustainable businesses, you know, and being able to give back to the community. And with the platform, and for medical purposes, it's really in aid of patients, of people.
You know, we live in a time, I guess, where people want to do good, they want to feel good, they want to have impact, but they also want to be successful, of course. But in this, you know, trying to improve things in the healthcare sector, do you think that's sort of brought interest to what you're trying to do from investors, say, or people that are trying to back you?
Absolutely, especially in the healthcare, you know. Right now, it's a $1 trillion business, as we know, globally. And a lot of those efforts aren't impacting, you know, the overall health of patients. So for investors, if they can see a potential where, you know, they can also make money but help people while doing it, I think that has attracted them a lot to just the whole premise of blockchain and healthcare and our platform.
I imagine that what you do in sort of the AI robotics technology part, like that's normal in the medical world. But when you're talking about cryptocurrency and blockchain and things like that, that in some corners of the medical world and healthcare is a little bit far out there. So
yeah.
How do you sort of marry those worlds and show where there is opportunity?
You know, in speaking with CEOs of large health systems, they know blockchain is the future. And it's really about the behavioral change that goes into that to actually get people's heads wrapped around cryptocurrency and blockchain. But for us, it's not more so about the technology than the impact and the ROI that it can have on the organization. So when we do sit down and, you know, educate these organizations about blockchain, you know, we're really pushing reduced costs, efficiency that the platform can provide to the organization.
I'm just curious about how in the U.S., I don't know if you've gone beyond the U.S. now, but in Canada, where I'm from, we obviously have a different healthcare system and universal healthcare. Mm-hmm. I wonder how what you're doing now, if it specifically only works in the private side of things or if it can work in different types of healthcare systems.
Yeah, we're actually speaking with a large Canadian health system right now. And really the benefit for them, again, is that information tracking that the ledger can provide to their institution, especially if the system consists of about like 23 hospitals that all are on different electronic medical record keeping systems, which inherently right now are siloed. So the opportunity for them to bring together their databases, you know, to provide better and efficient care for their population is also a play in this universal health model we see around the world.
I wonder if you could give me a few sort of concrete examples of how this can link both healthcare professionals and patients out there, how this sort of works in sharing of information, making things easier on both sides.
Yeah. So for us, we really, you know, are the platform providers. We're able to integrate with a hospital's or a healthcare organization's electronic medical record systems through the use of APIs. We actually don't store the data, but from there, you know, with this blockchain app, the patient can request through their public keys their information that may sit on this hospital database infrastructure, which then they're able to view that information and store it in their cryptographic wallet.
The whole point is the impact and seeing sort of the results. But having worked close to patients and seeing how that, you know, affects their lives and how important it is to people, what's sort of your hope and how you can impact people's lives?
Great question. I think that's why, you know, we do this as entrepreneurs. You know, the hope that people have is knowing that they can really rely on themselves, that empowerment for themselves to really decide, you know, this is how I want to live my lifestyle. And it's not basically dictated by someone they see probably twice a year. Or if they have chronic illnesses, you know, they see that person more frequently. But the ability to say, I know I might suffer from this illness, or, you know, I want to live a healthier lifestyle, I have the data and the information to be able to make sound decisions for myself.
That was Chrissa McFarlane, founder and CEO of Patientory, speaking to Monocle's Daniel Bates. You can hear the full episode looking at four startups making an impact in healthcare tomorrow at 1900 London time. You can, of course, catch up with that and all our other programming anytime you like on our website. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. It's time now on The Daily to take a look at the Australasian newspapers. I'm joined once again by Lloyd Burr, Europe correspondent for News Hub. Lloyd, I want to start with a story which News Hub is reporting of your country's former Prime Minister, Jenny Shipley, denying that she's moonlighting for a Chinese state newspaper. This is a very, very, very weird yarn. What is actually going on here?
This feud, I think we talk about New Zealand-China relationships every time I come on and talk to you, but this feud between New Zealand and China continues, and it all relates back to the fact that the government banned Huawei from building a 5G network in New Zealand. So the latest instalment of this feud, of this saga, is that a former Prime Minister, Dame Jenny Shipley, has been given a byline in an article in the People's Daily newspaper over there, and it's an article that's entitled, "We Need to Listen to China," and in it she praises allegedly praises Xi Jinping. She praises the Belt and Road Initiative. She calls it one of the greatest ideas we've ever heard globally. That's sort of very Trumpian, isn't it? And praises China's progress on women and equality for women as well. Now the funny thing is that the organisation I work for has contacted Jenny Shipley, Dame Jenny Shipley, and she says she didn't write that at all. She last spoke to the People's Daily in December. So they've just, on the face of it, they've just made this thing up based on an interview she gave last year.
So they've cannibalised her quotes from the interview and passed it off as an op-ed written for the paper.
Yeah, what it looks like when you read the paper is it looks like she's written an op-ed for the People's Daily talking about how great China is and how great their political system is and all that, but she's denying that she's written it. So, it's just another example of China fighting back against New Zealand.
A shabby journalistic stunt, and you'd certainly never catch any Western newspaper pulling anything of the sort. Utterly unheard of. Sticking with News Hub, who I hope are paying you on a percentage for these plugs for your organisation's own stories. But this is a really interesting story because this puts into very stark contrast that tension between having impeccable green credentials, which is something New Zealand prides itself on having and not without reason, and the fact that those credentials cost.
That's right. So at the beginning of last year, the New Zealand government, the new Labor-led government, implemented a ban on all new permits for oil exploration, offshore oil and gas exploration. So companies wouldn't be given permits to do this. And the petroleum groups and lobbyists and all that went up in arms. And over the last year, they've been doing this study. They got one of this really good New Zealand research group, NZIER, the New Zealand Institute of Economic Research, to do some studies to look at what the long-term impact of that decision would be, because it did come out of the blue. There was no consultation with the sector. It was quite random. This report has come to the conclusion that by 2050, this decision will harm the economy by around 30 billion New Zealand dollars. That's around 15 billion pounds. So that's the estimate. It's going to be about 3,000 jobs, I think, or just over 3,000 jobs will be gone because of this. So this is a report that's come back and actually shown what impact this decision will have. And it's quite shocking, really.
Well, to state the bleeding obvious, that is a consequential sack of cash. Has there been any response from the government to this? Because as I understand it, the oil and gas ban has not yet been entirely signed off on by Cabinet. It's not actually official yet, is it?
No, it is. So what they did, it was pretty easy for them to sign it off. They just meant that no new permits were given out. I think that they have this process where companies can bid on different areas of the offshore, all New Zealand's exclusive economic zone that were opened up, and they just weren't put out to tender for the 2018 year. Companies couldn't actually put bids on certain areas of the EEZ to go and probe and look around for oil and gas. So that's last year was the first year in which they couldn't do that. So it is still early days in the government's ban on this, and the impacts probably won't be felt for a long time because those with existing permits who got them before the new government came in can still probe around for oil and gas. So there are people whose jobs are safe for the sort of short term, but when those permits run out or there's no oil and gas left in the ground, their jobs will go.
Well, moving along to The Age out of Melbourne, and a story I suspect you've only bought in to try and do your bit to dissuade Europeans thinking of visiting the Southern Hemisphere.
I would never do that.
To forsake my country for yours. I mean, obviously, you know, people do joke about the hazards that can befall one in Australia. It's not like we need to come up with anything new. We've got enough. But apparently, we are where we are. What is going on? Well, actually, the interesting thing about this story is that no one really knows what's going on.
Exactly.
But tell us what we do know.
Okay. Well, for the record, I love Australia, and this isn't me trying to take a dig at you. But this is a fascinating story, really. It's about a flesh-eating ulcer epidemic that's broken out in Victoria State in Australia, that's sort of around the Melbourne area. That's pretty much how I'd describe it. But it's called a Borrelia ulcer epidemic. And what it is, it's a flesh-eating ulcer. It's a bacteria that gets into the skin. It releases toxins, and those toxins then rot the skin. And if it's not treated properly or cut out, then it can eat away at the bones. Now, they don't know why it's in Victoria, because it's a tropical infection. They don't know how it spreads. They've been trying to link, I think they've linked it to maybe possums passing it on to mosquitoes and mosquitoes passing it on to humans, but they've been out there doing soil samples and things like that. And the reason it's in the news is that there have been so many cases last year it was 340 cases. The year before that it was 200 and something. So it's going up quite significantly. Already this year there's been 28 cases of this flesh-eating disease. So, it's quite a fascinating thing that's going on in Victoria.
I do feel duty-bound to reassure our listeners that I was myself in Victoria as recently as last month. And so far, at least, touch wood, no symptoms. But it is a very, very weird one. As you correctly point out, it is not something that has any business being in Victoria, as far as we're aware, and yet there it is. It does, so far this story does just seem to be down to, it's just people, it's always really interesting when the official response is, yeah, we think this might just be one of those things that happens sometimes.
Yeah, and their only advice to people is to wear insect repellent, because they think it's coming from mosquitoes. So that's all the advice they're giving out, because they don't really know anything about it.
Well, that's reassuring. Moving along, finally, on the subject of things about which people don't seem to know all that much. This is the Guangzhou Daily. Baiyun Lake, as the headline says, is amazed by 2 meters long and, I quote, weird fish.
Yeah, that's Google Translate probably having a few issues there. And I don't speak Mandarin. But yeah, the Guangzhou Daily's got this fascinating yarn. And I wish we could show the photo. But there's this weird creature that has been sighted in the lake at a popular park. It's now the people who work at the park are now warning people not to swim in this area. I would sort of describe this as a crocodile that's been crossed with a dolphin, that's been crossed with a seal, that's kind of crossed with a snake as well. It's a bizarre looking animal, and they believe that it's called an alligator gar. Mm-hmm. And rangers have actually caught, I don't know if you use a fishing rod or a net or whatever, but they've managed to catch two of these things.
You'd want a bloody long handle on the net, I think.
Yeah, they've managed to catch two of them. One of them is 1.2 metres long, the other one's only just under a metre long. So they've managed to catch two of them. They think there's a few more in there, but they don't really know how they got into that lake, because there's more of them. They're usually found, should I say, in America, not in Asia. But I found some cool facts, actually. They're believed to be 100 million years old, and they can breathe both air and water. They're a dinosaur.
There's no potential relationship between alligator gars turning up in China and a strange tropical flesh-eating virus in Victoria. Are we at the beginning of some sort of film here, Lloyd?
It could be. They might be linked some way. Who knows?
Lloyd Burr with News Hub. Thank you, as always, for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Up next, Derek Jarman gets his own blue plaque.
On Meet the Writers this week, join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to Scandinavia's hottest new novelist, Niklas Natt-Ochdach. His name means night and day, and he's a member of Sweden's oldest existing noble family. A journalist, his debut novel, entitled 1793 in Swedish and The Wolf and the Watchman in English, has been a huge hit domestically and is now taking the rest of the world by storm. That's Niklas Natt-Ochdach on Meet the Writers, premiering this Saturday at 1500 London time, and thereafter available as a podcast.
You're listening to The Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. It's 25 years to the day since the death of the film director Derek Jarman at the age of 52. Today, one of English Heritage's blue plaques was unveiled at Butler's Wharf on London's South Bank, denoting the building where Jarman lived and worked for much of the 1970s, undertaking the experiments with Super 8 film, which would at least partially inform such acclaimed movies as The Angelic Conversation and The Last of England, among others. I'm joined now by Peter Tatchell, who spoke at today's unveiling. Peter the Plark says, Derek Jarman, filmmaker, artist, and gay rights activist. You knew Derek Jarman. Would he have regarded any one of those definitions as any more important than any of the others?
I think he saw himself as an artist in the wider, broader sense, an artist as a painter, a gardener, a filmmaker, a poet, an author, but also an artist as what he would prefer, a queer activist. He was a radical, dissenting queer. That's the way he described himself. And he made the point that for most of his life, he had the legal status of an unapprehended criminal under Britain's draconian anti-gay laws. He fought very hard with the LGBT group Outrage, which I was involved in, mm-hmm. to challenge those laws and the other areas of discrimination that afflicted the lives of LGBT people.
But as he saw it, was the role of activist in that sense, was it one he actively sought out, or was it the case, as often becomes the case when people acquire a measure of prominence, that the role of spokesman for whatever is perceived as their cohort is thrust upon them?
Well, I think, interestingly, his art and his activism were intertwined. Mm. So you see a film like Edward II, which tells the story of the ancient English king who had a male lover and was put to death, allegedly, by having a red-hot poker shoved up his anus. That homophobia for Derek was reflective of the contemporary homophobia of the 80s and 90s in Britain. And indeed, he got myself and other members of Outrage to have a bit part in that film, where suddenly it switched from Edward II's era to the modern day era, where we were at a protest chanting, "Stop violence against lesbians and gay men." And that switch between the historical narrative and the contemporary experience of LGBT people, which was still very violent in those days, I think was a mark of his ability to weave into his art a political message.
I wanted to ask how important you felt he was to punk in particular, because his film Jubilee is often thought of as, well, when you say the great punk movie, the competition for that title was not especially rigorous, but it is a great film. And I was just wondering, was there something in punk that he saw as a liberation, perhaps for different reasons than a lot of other punks did, but that was, when I've asked people who remember that era, that was what they saw it in. It was a sense of the old order being demolished.
Well, I think that was very much Derek's mantra. He was profoundly anti-establishment. He saw orthodoxy and convention as the enemy of humanity and liberation. So all his films in different ways challenge the consensus and, you know, capture or reclaim fragments of dissident ideas and experience, predominantly around LGBT issues, but not entirely. So Last of England and Jubilee and others had an agenda way beyond LGBT issues, and were, well, in this case, some of his work, you know, a damning indictment of the me first, greed is good Thatcherite era.
He was, I think I'm right in saying, one of the first, if not the first, public figures to publicly discuss his HIV positive status. How difficult a step was that, not just for him, but for anybody to take at that time? I mean, I am old enough to remember the tones in which HIV and AIDS were discussed at the time. And it must have been an extraordinarily brave step for him to take.
Yeah, well, in that era, in the 1980s, the popular consensus or the tabloid headlines were the gay plague, which will kill us all. You know, Daily Express had a headline, "A million will die by 1990 or something like that. It was very brave, and he was the first. And he did it at the world's first AIDS and Human Rights Conference, which I organised to coincide with the World Health Minister's Summit on AIDS, which took place in London in January 1988. And for him to come out in that way as, you know, quite a well-known and respected public figure and an acclaimed artist, that was very, very powerful. And I think it gave an incredible psychological and emotional boost to people with HIV who felt so intimidated and so threatened and so demonized by much of public opinion at that time.
Was he at all nervous, not just about that, but about his other enterprises in activism as well, that they would occlude what he did for a living, that they would somehow get in the way of the art, that that's what he would become known for? Or did he see it all as basically all parts of the same enterprise?
I think his personal life, his political life, his activist life, his artistic life were all part of one seamless whole. He didn't compartmentalize them. He weaved between and infused his art with the experience as a gay man who grew up in an era of criminalization and who witnessed the horrendous scale of anti-LGBT violence that was taking place in that era. I mean, you know, in the 80s, public opinion was over 70%, not only against LGBT people, but actually said that homosexuality is mostly always wrong in all circumstances. Over 70%. The scale of murders in the period 1986 to 1991, I did a rough, just without even trying, discovered that at least 51 gay and bisexual men had been murdered in that five-year period, in circumstances pointing to a homophobic motive. Yet at the time, the police were doing very, very little to actually properly investigate those murders and bring the perpetrators to justice. Very, very rarely do they do public appeals for witnesses. And, you know, in an informal, off-the-record sense, I got the impression from a lot of police officers that they thought, we got what we deserved. You are queers, you are perverts. You can't blame people who have a go at you. That was the police mentality in that day.
Not just here in the UK, I remember it being very common in Australia as well, where we're both from. You described Derek earlier in this conversation as anti-establishment. There are a few more establishment recognitions than a blue plaque from English Heritage. What do you think he would have made of it?
Probably he would have been uncomfortable, but of course it wasn't his doing. You know, I suppose the establishment does eventually try and claim those who have done notable things and pretend that they were never really a threat. I guess that Derek might have wanted something different, but, you know, he's got what he's got. It's not of his doing or saying. I mean, I think it's great because I think, you know, rebels and dissidents need to be recognised, and we need to recognise the contribution they've made to move society forward. And Derek was part of a movement of LGBT plus people in the 1980s and 1990s who did challenge the consensus, who turned things around, who said it wasn't homosexuality it was a problem, it was homophobia, and that society had to change, not us.
You knew Derek Jarman, obviously. Just finally, and just on a personal note, what do you think of when you think of him as somebody who you knew and to spend time with?
An incredibly humble and simple man. I mean, he could have made millions. If he'd gone into commercial cinema, he could have been a great Oscar-winning director and made millions. But he wanted to do what he believed in. He followed his conscience. And on a personal level, he was such fun to be around. He was always laughing and smiling. And even in the last years as he was dying of HIV, you know, he'd never, ever hold back on a joke. He'd always lift your spirits when you went to see him in hospital. And that's a real tribute of a man of great humanity and integrity.
Peter Tatchell, thank you as always for joining us. That is it for today's edition of The Daily. The show was produced by Augustin Macellari and Ben Ryland. The researcher was Daphne Karnesis. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now with Emma Nelson. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow, playing us out just quickly in honour of Derek Jarman, Susie and the Banshees, who did, of course, have a cameo in his 1978 film Jubilee that we were just discussing. I'm Andrew Mullett. Thank you for listening.